Hi, Bobby here. Just a quick note to say that the episode we were going to release today, there are some audio issues that are going to take a little bit longer to resolve. So instead, the episode you'll hear today is a re-release, one of the most popular episodes from our back catalogue, and we'll resume normal programming next week with the episode that should have gone out. So for now, please enjoy one of our favourite episodes.
This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about burnout with Anne Helen Peterson. She's a senior culture writer at BuzzFeed News and an author of a book very relevant to today's theme. So first off, we've got two definitions, the first from Cambridge English Dictionary, that burnout is an extreme tiredness or feeling of not being able to work anymore caused by working too hard. And I think that's the definition that many of us will be most familiar with. But I wanted to add a second one from Urban Dictionary, which is much broader, a state of emotional or physical exhaustion. And that kind of links to the interview today, because so often burnout is seen primarily as a workplace-based issue of people just overworking, whereas as the understanding is growing, particularly on how it impacts our mental health, people are understanding that you can be burnt out in other areas of your life as well, that raising children can... Danielle's nodding.
I think you said that because you were about to see me interrupt with and then you filled in the gap form.
yeah, so you know, raising children, moving house can cause burnout, the adjustment to that. Equally, if you're studying, you can have burnout from your studies. So really the second definition there is the one I'm a lot more comfortable with, and I think appreciates how this is an issue that's not isolated. That even if you do primarily have workplace burnout, there's probably other issues going on. I would say it's very rare. I certainly don't personally know of any examples where it's just the workplace that's the issue.
I agree. And I love the idea of this episode and with this guest, because you're absolutely right. There's such a broader conversation that needs to be had around burnout. And you've just mentioned it all, really. I think one thing that's hitting me in the face is like burnout from lockdown.
Yeah.
And it's ironic because, you know, we associate, as you said, the word burnout, you know, working too hard and literally like run off your feet and not giving yourself the time for the things. But this whole pandemic, we're at a point now where we're like a few days before school, or perhaps we'll have just started school by the time this episode goes out.
So it'll be Thursday.
Yeah. So today is school day. And I think for so many parents and people looking after children who are just literally burnt out with that, because it's not only that you've been caring for children, it's that you've been also trying to work, and you've also been trying to sort out the house and make sure that you've got your finances in order, and all of those things have really can cause and have caused for a lot of people burnout. Absolutely.
You know, it's a really good reminder of why this is such an important issue for us, particularly as we talk a lot about in the interview. We're in a more 24/7 world now. You know, we're online so much more. We're socializing not just in person, but in so many other ways. So for many people in my life, particularly those that are younger, their primary communication is newer technology. They're constantly on WhatsApp or Messenger, or they're playing like, I'm sounding like such an old man even trying to describe what the youth are doing. But like what I'm trying to compare is, like, for me, my socializing prior to lockdown certainly is primarily trying to see people in person. If not, I'm speaking to people on the phone. And yet a lot of people, including millennials who we'll be talking about today, are very averse to being on the phone. And perhaps lockdown might be a bit of a change to that, because we're on video calls more. And so we're getting more used to that. Even still, to get back to my point, there's more pressure than ever, right? There's always that inbox for our emails waiting for things. There's always people online on Facebook we could be talking to. And so it's a lot harder to turn off. But also this creates other types of burnout, because you can have it like social burnout as well.
Well, absolutely. And to put testament to that, and that absolutely excellent point there about the social media side of it, that Zoe Sugg and Jordan from Rizzle Kicks, the group, are launching Digital Detox Day on September the 5th, where they're urging all people to put down your phone, and that, you know, obviously if you need to make calls or whatever you need to do, but ideally to not do anything digital on Saturday, September the 5th. So this Saturday it launches. And I thought that was a brilliant initiative when I was researching it and saw some information around that. I thought, what a great thing to do, just to see. I wonder how, you know, there's so many of us that think, oh, I'll be fine. I don't need to go on my phone. I don't need this. But my phone literally moves around the house with me.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Literally.
And you know that I'm so much worse because I generally do a lot of my work on my iPad. So then I've got my iPad and my phone just traveling everywhere.
Yeah. And I'm not overly on social media too much. I might have a scroll through Instagram, which we all know a scroll through Instagram for 10 minutes can be an hour. But I'm not on, you know, Snapchat. I'm not on Twitter all the time. You know, I kind of maybe use it for work more, social media, but, you know, Facebook, all of that, I'm not really on it. And even, I think even for me, if I'm totally honest, I'll find it hard to not be on my phone or use any digital device for the whole day. I might challenge you.
Yeah. But no, I know what you mean. And it's one of those things you maybe take for granted. You don't realize how much you use it. And then your battery dies. And you realize, like, oh, I've got like 10 things I've wanted to Google, or I've wanted to check the weather or the bus times. You know, I can't just stand at a bus stop. I need to know when the bus is coming. I need the live time.
Yeah. And I think for me, actually, just thinking about it then, I know you again, you're not a WhatsApp user too much.
No,
I am. So that WhatsApp's probably my thing then, actually, just thinking about it, that I will really struggle with. You know, I'll be out with my family and my other half will be like, you really have to post that right now to like all your groups. You know, I'm out with the kids and take a photo and I've got my dad's side of the family that needs to see it. My mum needs to see it. Everybody needs to see it in real time. He's like, Dan. And sometimes I think, oh, it's fine. It's only that's a quick thing, but it's not. It's still being disengaged in the moment. It's still taking a photo and sending it to somebody. That doesn't help as well, the fact we've got photos on our phones, because you get it out for photos all the time and then you see a message, especially with children, you kind of get your phone out and do videos and stuff. But WhatsApp would be my thing, Bob. I've always got like six WhatsApp chats going on like simultaneously.
We are coming across as more of a slave to our devices than I think perhaps we acknowledge.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about this now, thinking, oh my God, it sounds terrible. But I'm going to do it and challenge you to do it September the 5th. And our listeners, Digital Detox Day. Let's do it.
The listeners may have noticed I've made no promises.
I know.
We will see. I'm working on a new podcast, which we'll be telling the listeners about soon. So we will see. To circle back to our research, perhaps a little bit ironically, given what we've been talking about, most of the research is geared at workplaces. That is the type of burnout that's still the most understood. And so I've got a few stats that I did find really interesting from a Deloitte survey in 2015 on employee burnout. And they found that 83% of respondents say that burnout from work can negatively affect their personal relationships. Next up, nearly 70% of professionals feel their employers are not doing enough to prevent or alleviate burnout within the organisation. Then to bring in the millennial expert, so our guest book is called Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Usually these are people that are born between 1981 to 1996. So they're people off the top of my head who I think are 26 to 40.
39, because if you're born in 1980, you're 40 this year. No, I'm not going to say any more about how I know that. But yeah, 1980, obviously, we're 2020, aren't we? So yeah, 81 would mean that you're 39, yeah, at the end of this year. You'd still be 39. Cool. God, it's like going into that new box of sign if you're between 40 and 55. It's like shit.
God, we're having all kinds of realizations
today. We are.
Right. So, yeah, so that's an idea of the millennial generation. Although, like I said, it partly depends who you ask, how that's defined. A lot of people think it only goes up to 2000, which makes sense given the name. Although it was named millennial afterwards. It was originally called Generation Y.
Yeah.
That's a bit of nerdy generation knowledge. So back to our guest. So she specifically looked at how millennials are disproportionately experiencing burnout and the factors, many of which we've touched on a little bit, that make our modern world a part of that story, really. So I've got two stats relating to that as well, again from Deloitte. They found burnout particularly affects millennial retention in workplaces, with 84% saying they have experienced burnout at their current job, compared to 77% of all respondents. Also, nearly half of millennials say they have left a job specifically because they felt burnt out, compared to 42% of all respondents. And that one I found quite shocking, to think nearly half of people from this age bracket have left a job for this reason. So no wonder our previous episode was so popular, Burnout with Suki Bassi. But equally, it should be talked about so much more.
Absolutely, but there's a stigma that's attached to it. And people don't want to say, I was just too stressed, I was burnt out, I couldn't cope. And so absolutely it should be talked about more. And that says a lot. And it goes back, you know, why we do this show in the first place, to reduce that stigma.
And it's something that I think really needs to go into the bin, that idea of you work hard and that is the only way to work. You know, not working smart, not working at the right job. It's just all about working hard. And that's how you get ahead. And that's very much the mentality I was raised with. And I credit a lot of that to my work ethic. But burnout is a very good example of how it has its flaws. There are many issues you'll come across in a workplace where working harder is not the answer. And burnout is one where actually it'll make it worse. So on that point, we will get ready to go into the interview with our guest. So Anne Helen Peterson was really insightful on many of the areas we've touched on and was able to break down the immense amount of research she's done into this book on why this is an issue that is just so prevalent and that may well, unless things change, become even more and more common. So we hope you find the interview as interesting as we did, and do check out the episode with Suki Bassi. I'll link it in the episode description as well if you want more on this topic. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Anne Helen Peterson, and the first time that I can really remember thinking about mental health was my mom talking about getting counseling when she was in her 20s and 30s, because her mom had never sought any sort of counseling and had just medicated herself by taking, you know, lithium, which was very popular in America in the 1950s and 60s, to just prescribe like a bunch of meds that would put someone out like on the couch. My mom had memories of like her mom being so anxious that she had to just like put herself out in order to cope with the world. And so that, I think, was my understanding of mental health, was that either you did something like that, right? Or you went to counseling as a result of having a mom like that. Or you were like me, which was that you were just fine and you didn't need any help. And of course, that's wrong. There were all sorts of habits and bad mental health hygiene that I adopted over the years. And I think one of them, and this again goes back to early childhood, watching my mom. She was a professor and then started writing books on the side, textbooks on the side. And she would work all the time. So work on weekends, work on, you know, after dinner, on weekdays. And that was just really normalized. The fact that you could be working all of the time, working in all of the kind of crevices of your life. And I became an academic. My brother became an academic. Like that was just something that when we came home for break, you know, whether it was on Christmas, right? Like a holiday that we could all be spending together, I would still be doing my work. Like I wrote my dissertation, was writing my dissertation on Christmas Day. I remember this so clearly. And so that normalization, workaholism really, is kind of the broad memory of mental health in my house.
Wow. That's really interesting background. And I feel like it sort of links to what we'll be talking about a little bit in terms of mental health being seen as a barrier to your work. That if your mental health is poor, that is a problem. And if there's something you can take to fix it, or some kind of fast track way, Or maybe you just work through it. And that's where a lot of burnout comes from.
Totally. Even just like any part of your personality as a barrier to working all the time, right? How can you eliminate the parts of your life and the parts of yourself that make it harder to work all the time?
Yeah. And I've definitely had a quite similar experience with my family, being from an immigrant background, having two parents that work in medicine, you know, very academic family members. You know, when people ask me nowadays of how do you work so hard, how do you find the sort of energy and the drive for it? And I have to say, well, I had a part-time parent that worked 5 days a week and a full-time parent that worked 6 days a week. Like my paradigm of how much work is normal is completely skewed.
Yes.
And so did you find that bled into the kind of expectations of you through your academia and then going into the workplace?
I think so. You know, and it was never that I was doing this because like I was trying to please my parents like that. I think sometimes people get this idea that like, oh, you work so hard to like meet your parents' expectations. But like the only expectation for me were the ones that I set myself, right? And I do think, though, that the larger story behind those expectations and what I internalized by watching my mom was that you worked in order to keep yourself afloat during times of precarity. So times when the future was uncertain financially, you know, family-wise, you know, after my parents got divorced, like my mom really started working all the time. Work was the way that you found grounding, found stability. And in academia, there was never a stable ground, right? Like the academic market is so unstable. The future is so unstable. There was never any place where I was like, oh, I feel secure in this moment. And so my coping mechanism was always just, I can work harder. That is the one thing I can do, is I can work more. I can have a better work ethic. And so that was something that I developed as anytime I felt bad, anytime I felt scared, anxious, exhausted, I would just turn to work as a grounding.
Right. And it's scary, I think, how common that is. And I see it as I've grown to understand burnout more. I've become a lot better at spotting it. And, you know, when you see it, particularly in other people, like it's easy to kind of fall into it yourself and it's easier to see it in other people. And so you'll see someone is really struggling with their work. And so often the default answer is, I'll work more.
Yeah.
And I don't know what other issues we think this is causing me problems. I'll do more of it.
Yeah, I know, right? You're like, oh, diminishing returns, right? Like as you continue to stare at the computer screen, not being able to do the thing that you need to do, feeling incredible anxiety about it. You know that you're not getting anything back from it, but it feels incredibly difficult to step away from that problem.
Mm.
I think we are so untrained in the idea that less work or stopping work can actually make your work better, right? Can actually lead to you solving the problem. You know, the American work ethic in particular, which I think has continued to spread into other cultures, is like you drive straight towards the problem and you just like force your way through it instead of trying to think creatively or thinking, oh, well, maybe I'm exhausted and don't have any sort of ability to deal with this right now. I should step away. But that idea of not working, of pausing, of stepping away is so anathema to the American work ethic.
Well, from my perspective, that does feel quite American, the idea of sort of driving through the problem. It's a very direct approach that we have less so in the UK.
Well, and you can even see it right now in the approach to the pandemic. America's like, if we just keep driving, everything's going to be fine, right? It's just, it's a horrible, horrible approach. But no one can take the time to really rethink it.
That's tricky. And I think we could talk about the politics of that all day, of potentially certain nations maybe developing a level of confidence where they're like, we just stick with what's worked in the past. It'll never need to change. But I think in a way, there's a parallel with burnout there, that a lot of what worked for previous generations is now expected to work for millennials. And that's a lot of the focus of your writing, of in many ways, we seem more vulnerable to it than ever before.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point, because it is looking at a lot of these processes in terms of attitude towards work, increased precarity just in general. Like, these are things that don't start and stop with the boundaries of millennial, the dateline of millennials, right? It's not like, oh, you have this workaholism if you were born between 1980 and 1995 precisely. It's more that these processes that have been put in place, these coping mechanisms, these ways of thinking about the world and the placement of work within it, they have been the case, I would say, since post-World War II. And then gradually some of the safety nets that have made it possible to like relax a little bit, to not work all the time, to have that relief from the precarity, those safety nets have fallen away. And at the same time, the amount of work that is required and the amount of slippage between work time and non-work time, right? Like any sort of boundaries between when work is performed and when it is not performed, what leisure is, those have slipped away more. And so what you have is this incredible consolidation of these processes that have been in motion for some time, for many decades, on boomers, on Gen X, but they're just all coming to a head on millennials and of course on Gen Z, whatever you want to call like this next generation. But millennials just are coming of age in this moment, are coming into their 30s, their late 20s, and thus are becoming aware of like the full extent. The fact that like, oh, I graduated from college, I got my first job, I'm settled down, I have kids even, but like nothing has changed. If anything, everything's just gotten worse.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought. And I think actually in many ways, the pandemic is a chance for better or worse to reflect on that. It's sort of difficult, particularly when you're hitting those kind of key milestones like turning 30, not to think about where you are in comparison to your parents.
Yes.
And, you know, and so we often talk about things like the ability to buy houses is very different for our generation than previous ones. And in your article for BuzzFeed, you talk about this kind of automated expectation that every generation has a better time than the last. And maybe we've kind of reached a point now where that's not true this time.
Yeah. Oh, it's for sure not true, right? Like, we are the first generation since World War II to really take a step back in terms of overall economic prosperity, even things like health expectations and that sort of thing, like whether that's because of anxiety or because of all sorts of other mental health concerns, combined with the physical concerns that like kind of stem from burnout broadly and like the societal afflictions that we have in this moment. There are enough people who realize that, who know that. Either they've seen the statistics or they feel it like just in their bones that like we are taking a step back from our parents' generation. We're the first ones to be that step back. And that feeling, like what that does to a person and to a larger social group, it's pretty profound in terms of optimism, how you think about the future, how you think of the very present and what sort of decisions you want to make in your immediate life. But I really agree that the pandemic has offered this moment for reflection for so many people. And I don't mean to trivialize like the incredible suffering that people have been dealing with in terms of like actually dealing with COVID-19, the disease. But for those of us who are stuck in our homes, unemployed or employed, there is space for contemplation in a way that there has not been.
Yeah. And even in addition to that, the pandemic is becoming part of the problem. That as much as there's the health crisis to grapple with, there's the economic crisis that we are realizing is looming more and more, as almost like when we get through this, we then have that to look forward to. And that's a lot less of a hopeful place to be in.
Yeah. Well, and even all the things that contribute to burnout, from like reliance on digital technologies, real exhaustion from contemporary parenting expectations, all of those things are accelerated by the pandemic. So if you thought parenting was hard before, like parenting is a nightmare now, when if your kids are at home and you don't have the release valve of allowing them to go to school or to daycare, that sort of thing. And there are just so many other systems as well. This is particularly true in America, but I think we've seen it in other countries as well. These systems that we've known are pretty broken, or are flailing or diseased, their vulnerabilities have just really become impossible to ignore. And like, you know, that might not feel like it directly affects personal burnout, but all of these societal failures, they make it harder to feel like you have any sort of solid footing. they create this overarching environment of precarity that makes it feel like you need to work all the time. You always need to be hustling. And that contributes to the feeling of burnout for sure.
Definitely. And what you've got me thinking about is the requirements of working nowadays and how that's changed. I mean, who knows what work will look like after the pandemic, if we'll even many of us have offices to go back to. So if you're struggling to feel financially stable, and then there's all the social media stuff we always talk about of having to present this perfect self online, all of this is going on and it all dampens creativity, which we're also needing to have more than ever. I run a podcast. You know, there's more and more people that have creative work like mine than ever before. And yet it's so much more difficult to be creative when you're worried about your future.
Yes, absolutely. And even just, it's so much harder to be creative when you are not giving your brain any form of legitimate rest. So I think of the fact that, like, whenever I have a free moment, like if I'm waiting in line at the supermarket, or if I, you know, waking up first thing in the morning or trying to fall asleep at night, my phone fills those spare moments where in the past, your brain would really be kind of at rest, right? There is a definition of solitude, which is freedom from other people's minds, right? So that means like you're not listening to a podcast, you are not talking to someone else, you are not looking at your phone and looking at someone's Instagram post. You're just hanging out with your own mind. And those are incredibly rejuvenating moments. They're fonts of creativity. They might not seem like it in the moment. You don't have to be like coming up with a new idea. It's actual genuine rest for your brain so that you can later come up with that idea. But we have excised so many of those moments of rest, legitimate rest, like actual sleep, right? But also just like repose from our lives. And it's weird to say that sometimes we feel too tired to do anything else but look at Instagram, when just staring at the wall would actually be more restful than looking at Instagram. But it's hard. That compulsion is there to just constantly always be doing something, to be activating our mind in some way, even if it feels meaningless.
Yeah, I really feel that. And you're reminding me of a writer I love called Manoush Samarote. And she writes a lot about boredom and how we've kind of lost it. And you don't just lose the ability to do nothing and be okay with that. You also lose the inspiration that can come from that. You know, we all know stories of like great inventors that thought of a thing in a bath. And yet, yeah, you know, I'd say more than ever, people are listening to podcasts and we have this to-do list. And some of that is very structured, even the fun stuff. You know, we're so used to like looking at Netflix now and thinking, do I have time for an hour program or a half hour program? And our lives then become very rotated, even when we're not working, which is what I love about your writing, because we've covered burnout previously and it was very much focused on the workplace. And that's a very important conversation. But I definitely feel burnout goes far beyond that.
So I think of it as the optimization of leisure. So taking leisure activities and thinking of them in terms of, how can I package this in a way that will look good on Instagram, right? How can I watch TV shows that will make it so that I am a more interesting conversationalist? You know, previously when we would hang out in person, but now, you know, like whether you're posting about it on Twitter or you're texting about it or whatever, like oftentimes we are not consuming things or doing things simply to do them, simply because they feel actually relaxing or restorative or nourishing in some way, but because we care about how they reflect on us as cultural consumers. Yeah. So something like, I'm really into gardening. I love vegetable gardening. The vegetables that I grow, like I live in the mountains in Montana. They are not beautiful. They do not supply our home with vegetables every day. Like they are not utilitarian in any sort of way. The reason I do it is because the everyday process of looking at the vegetables gives me pleasure. But I have to continually fight myself and be like, oh, well, my vegetables aren't pretty enough to really Instagram. Who cares, right? Like what matters, the activity is what matters. Not being the best at it, not the way that it's photographed, like none of those things, not how it reflects on me. What matters is that I actually want to do it. And I think we've lost sight of that. And a lot of younger millennials in particular, there was this imperative that every single activity that you do has to be geared in some way to getting into college, to put it on your resume, to make you into a more well-rounded person. When really, like, you know, maybe working a crap job is what makes you a more well-rounded person. Or, you know, staring at the wall is what makes you a more well-rounded person. There are all of these things that, like, you do not need to be the best at, I don't know, rowing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like fun has got commoditized. It's like you can't go on a sports holiday. You have to be entering a competition.
Yes, like, absolutely.
You know, you can't cycle because it's fun. You've got to get all the kit and do it competitively.
Yes.
No, it's so interesting. I've never heard anyone quite articulate it like that. And yet you're absolutely right. And it absolutely sounds exhausting the way you describe it, constantly thinking of how this will look. And I think that's a big difference I notice between myself and my parents' generation is that for them with consuming news, for example, it was enough to consume news generally. Like if you watch it once a day or if you get a paper weekly or daily, however much news you consume, you know what's going on is enough. Whereas yeah. I think myself and many people in my life feel a pressure to be very specific about it. So not only do I have to know what's going on, I kind of have to know how to argue my side of it. And this is part of the kind of divided politics we have. So I noticed that a lot with the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, that I felt a pressure not only to keep up to date on it, but also to be very intellectual about it, because I knew people would probably want to challenge my perspective. And I felt the need to be like, okay, well, you know, this government minister said this, but they also said this. Did you see this other news story? No wonder, in a way, so many people struggle with confidence issues or anxiety when there's this constant, what will the other people think?
Right. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things like about the Black Lives Matter movement is that in the past, there was kind of this passivity to the way that we consume news in terms of like, I read about what's happening, I can form my opinion on whether that's good or not. But especially if you are from a group of people who is, you know, the status quo in power, you can also just be like, I support Black Lives Matter, but I don't need to say anything about it, right? Like that reticence and that passivity. But I do think, you know, you cannot disarticulate what's going on with Black Lives Matter from the fact that we do have this space of contemplation that accompanies the quarantine, right? There is a reason why people are finding the actual time to show up for protests, but also spending more time trying to figure out how to articulate their position, especially white people trying to figure out like, do I stay silent? Like I need to show support, but also not dominate the conversation, trying to negotiate that space, which is very uncomfortable and anxiety producing. But I have seen those arguments, you know, some people are like, you should feel like crap right now as a white person. You should feel horrible. And then other people who are struggling with mental health issues just generally related to the quarantine and then other parts of their life are like, you're telling me to continue to feel like to feel even more crappy? So trying to find a balance between those two things is difficult. But I think, you know, the point that you made about your parents only consuming news like once a day, there's no reason why I need to be looking at the news every 10 minutes. The news is still the news of the day. It might be updated slightly, but the only reason is my own compulsion, my own anxiety about missing something, being not part of that larger conversation, when a much healthier way to consume news is to be able to consume it, you know, maybe once a day. Maybe some of the things, some ideas, some events are actually better processed if they come a week later, right? If there's some perspective on what's happening. But we have no, not only patience, but also just there's not a lot of room for that sort of exhale, that time to be able to process something. Millennials in particular, you have to react right now. And if you don't react, you'll miss it.
Yeah. And in many ways, that is a very social media thing, that's how we're encouraged to use social media, because like a trending hashtag or a news story that will flood a platform and then disappear very quickly, it encourages that way of thinking that we are going to miss out. And, you know, really links to a lot more of our social lives being digital. You know, you don't worry about that, I think, in other situations in the same way. Like keeping up with what your work colleagues are doing is like still somewhat a sacred space for me, of like, I don't really get too involved with them on social media because I know I'm seeing them at work. And so that is my time to be like, how has your weekend been? But I think a lot of people will have that. And for many people, it can feel all consuming that you have to be up to date on everything constantly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I, as a journalist and other people who are very keyed into what is happening in the moment, there is this feeling that if you give yourself permission to walk away, even for a day, that you have somehow failed, right? Like that you are behind and that you need to catch up. And I think treating burnout for people in those professions, any profession where it feels like you have to be plugged in all the time, one of the most important things is like learning, teaching yourself that you can miss a day and it's fine. Right? Like there are ways to catch up and maybe you are actually getting the best of the best. Like you get to read the best thing that's been written instead of all of the things that have been written. You don't have to deal with like that huge sea of information and the energy, the exhaustion of trying to seek out all of the different opinions at once.
Right. For sure. I think that's so important. And it's strange to think about because it almost feels like an imaginary time when you went on holiday to, let's say, a foreign country, and unless you brought a paper with you or something was such a big story that it made news there, you would have very little idea what was going on in the UK or wherever you're from.
Right.
Like you would just have an entire break from that. And the idea of that happening now, I don't even know what I'd do. I'd have to put my phone in a box or go somewhere without Wi-Fi, not let anybody call me. Like, I'm not even sure if it'd be possible to be that disconnected now.
Well, last year I saved up for a trip to Fiji, which is someplace that I've always wanted to go. And I was totally disconnected while I was there. Like I didn't turn on my phone, like except for to, you know, text my parents to let them know I got there, that sort of thing. And there were all of these signs on these islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that were like, we're sorry that you can't, our internet is not fast enough for you to video conference. Right. So people were coming to Fiji with the expectation that they would be able to work from Fiji. Like what? What is, like it's, and we're not, I'm not talking about like people who work from Fiji. I'm talking about vacationers who wanted to be able to do their normal work routines from Fiji, like from the beach.
Yeah, that's really scary. And I feel slightly called out because I can be a bit like that when I'm away. You know, if the Wi-Fi isn't what I'm used to, then I feel that feeling of being disconnected.
Yeah.
And it's a really unsettling thing. And it's almost more unsettling because I'm like, why is this so upsetting to me?
Yes. Well, you take a step back. And this is the thing that I've learned with burnout is you can take a step back from your behaviors and be like, this is a burnout behavior. Like, I am reacting ridiculously to a slightly slow email connection. This is a burnout behavior, right? And I try in my own life not to be really hard on myself when I do start kind of descending into more burnout behaviors. Instead of being like, ugh, can't believe this is happening again, like so mad at myself, I just want to be able to step back and identify it and be like, okay, how can I start making some small changes in my life? If this is the path that I'm heading down again, how can I try to push it back? You know, make some more boundaries in my life to cordon off work a little bit more in an effective way.
Right. I think that's a really great proactive way of looking at it. And was there a particular time where you had that realization that burnout was an issue for you and you would need to take more attention to it?
Well, I noticed it actually like in the second month of the pandemic, I had downloaded like a crappy like Candy Crush knockoff game for my phone. Mm-hmm. And every night before falling asleep, I couldn't read any fiction. I'm a voracious consumer of fiction. I couldn't read any books. When I wasn't just looking at like the pandemic numbers, I was playing this game, which was not a hard game, was not a challenging game, was not an interesting game in any way, but it was a clear manifestation of me not wanting to engage with anything else, right? I needed mindlessness in some capacity. And I allowed myself, I was like, I know that this is like a burnout behavior, that I am resorting to this game because of these other pressures, these other forms of exhaustion in my life. But then there came a point after about like 3 weeks, well, I'm not going to stop doing this on my own. Like, I'm going to continue to open this up before I go to bed. So I'm just going to delete it off my phone, because that will, you know, just make the choice go away, and turn off my internet on my phone before I go into my bedroom. And so I can either stare at the wall or fall asleep or meditate or read a book. And slowly I started choosing a book. And now I'm back into my process of reading fiction, which, you know, feels incredibly restorative to me, to just enter into a different space and to have it have nothing to do with the rest of my work. You know, this stuff, it's not nonfiction, it's always fiction. But it took the process of pretty much 6 months to go from that space of burnout into choosing again the thing that I actually wanted to choose.
Wow. And I think that's a way we need to think about it more, right? Because there's such this concept of it being like a breaking point that you get to a certain point and then suddenly you have burnout. And in reality, it's a buildup of these behaviors and stresses, which many of them can be at work, but definitely they can be outside of work. And all this combination gets worse and worse. And so the burnout point that we talk about is really where you're so burnt out that you can't pretend things are okay anymore, or you can't just get by and something has to change.
Yeah. And most people don't experience it that way. They just experience burnout as like this backdrop of their life. It's always there. Sometimes they feel it more, sometimes they feel it less. But it's not something that going on vacation or the end of the pandemic will fix. And to me, part of that, the reason for that is because it's so interwoven with our current iteration of capitalism. So until capitalism changes, it's going to be with us. But there are ways that we can choose to resist it and that we can choose to have a different relationship with it in our lives.
Yeah. And so my understanding from what you mentioned of capitalism there, that for at least the foreseeable future, our work lives and our lives kind of more generally will always to a degree be governed by other people's finances.
Yeah. And the insecurity of our own finances, right? So when you have security in your job, and whether that's through a union, whether that's through living in a country where there are robust social services so that if you lose your job, you'll still be okay. You have some sort of security in your life in that capacity. It frees you up to think about all sorts of other things, right? It frees you towards creativity. Like, it allows you the space to think about other things in your life that are overwhelmed by always thinking about money, always thinking about security, always thinking about the future. So if you can take away that piece of the anxiety puzzle, it just gives you so much more space to work on yourself instead of just always trying to, you know, stay with your head above water.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, that idea of treading water. And you've really got me thinking about the idea of burnout behaviors and what some of mine are. And I definitely feel one of my pandemic ones has to do with lack of cleaning. That normally I'm quite regular with cleaning and I like to have a routine with it. And there's a very direct correlation with how stressed I'm feeling, and including how much pressure there is on my mental health, how there may be struggles there, and how messy my flat is. Of like, that's sort of one of those tipping points where, like, if I'm only just holding down everything else, then I cannot face cleaning. And yet normally that's actually something I enjoy.
Right. And that makes you feel better about your lived environment. It feels clarifying, at least for me, cleaning does. I know not for everyone. And this goes back to like reading fiction. The thing that I think often describes burnout, and this has similarities to depression, is that it feels so difficult to choose the thing that you actually want to choose. You want to clean. You take pleasure in it, right? But it feels like an impossible endeavor to do that thing because you're so busy and fatigued with doing all the other things. And to clean would take away from that focus that you have to cultivate on those other things. That to me was always the thing with this as part of my piece about errand paralysis, like the inability to do those small things on your to-do list that are a part of, you know, being an adult in the world, is that they seemed impossible to tackle because it seemed like they would take too much time, even if it was just an hour, It would take too much time away from that necessity to be focusing on your work at all times.
Yeah, and it's very easy to fall into that trap. You know, there's always an email refresh button there. And particularly, you know, I'm a good or maybe a bad example, depending how you look at it, of that, where, you know, I'm interviewing you on a different time zone. Like, I'm getting emails at all hours. And so very easily, I could find work to do at any time of day. And I'm glad that you've mentioned depression, because it's very closely linked for me. And I'd be interested to know if you see a lot of this. So I kind of have this cycle that I've learned to recognize, where a way that I cope with depression and a way that I've sort of, I guess, found to partly overcome it is via my work. You know, I have work that I'm really passionate about, that I really enjoy, and that takes a lot of my time. And that gives me the motivation that the depression doesn't want to. And, you know, sometimes that's healthy and positive, and other times I'm falling into workaholism because I'm feeling those feelings of depression bubbling up. And I'm like, if I stop working, I don't know when I'll feel able to start again.
Right. Yeah. I know a lot of people who face a similar kind of conundrum in terms of like, work is the way that I stave off that depression, right? But it's also, it's like, you can't stop running. You have to keep running. And, you know, if you keep running every day and never stop, you eventually run out of gas. You're like exhausted. You can't keep going. And I don't think it's necessarily always the most, it's not a solution. It's a fix, right? It's a temporary fix to stave off depression and other feelings that are like any, you know, mental health issues that you're grappling with in your life, but it's not a solution. Like you said, it leads to all sorts of other problems as well.
Yeah.
I personally find it hard to disentwine, you know, the two are so related. Like, so many of the symptoms I think of burnout are similar to symptoms of depression. And it's really difficult for someone with no training like me to ever identify or disentangle them for someone else. But I do think that, you know, that exhaustion with the contemporary world, like all of these things that have historically been diagnosed as burnout or world weariness, or, you know, after the war, like all of these different wars, like different afflictions that people had, it was just an inability to cope with the world as it is. So how do we disentangle levels of chemicals in the brain from how we are grappling with the society around us? I think it's really difficult to do that. And you can't give medicine to society other than, like, I don't know, voting for change. That's a long answer to say that, like, I think that we have to have these conversations.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting. It kind of links back to where we started our conversation with you talking about family and this kind of idea that mental health was this thing to be fixed. And, you know, the more I run a platform like this, the more I learn that it's just a big spectrum and that all of this stuff goes on there. And, you know, I speak to guests all the time with conditions that I 100% don't have. But that doesn't mean I don't have crossover of symptoms. And, you know, I should say for the record, in terms of my experience of depression, work has been far from the only thing that's been a part of my recovery. And that is why I've been able to recover, because burnout has definitely been an issue. And I would have just been kind of yo-yoing between the two if I didn't have other support like counselling, active ways of working through issues. So yeah, in terms of where you are now with understanding burnout and experience of identifying the factors in yours, is there anything else you'd like to share on what's been useful?
I think just to build on what you just said, it's always a process, something that I am grappling with. There is no burnout cure, at least in this moment, right? And I think sometimes we want there to be a book that tells us, do these things and you'll cure your burnout. But as you said, it's a more holistic, more like 360 degree view of like, here are all of the different parts of my life and in the society that surrounds me that are causing this thing. How can I try to think about and attend to as many as possible? And a book will certainly not fix it. Neither will like an organizational app or anything like that. It's much larger than that.
For sure. Although the good news is you have a book where it may not have a simple answer. And like you say, I don't think there is one, but it will help people explore this concept of burnout and try and wrap their head around it. Do you mind talking a bit about that?
Yeah, I do have a book. It's coming out soon in September. And I think that sometimes the book industry, publishing industry, wants you to have like a prescription to be like, here are the things, here's the 5 takeaways from this book that you can do to cure your burnout. And I really resisted that. And what the book does, as you said, is it offers the language to try to describe what we're going through and also have continued conversations about it and just grapple with it. So it gives a full vision of it, of what burnout is in this moment, and then tries to think about what we can do as a society to try to face it moving forward. And it goes through everything from the history of it in terms of like, how did our parents deal with burnout? Because they absolutely did. To how do parents deal with burnout? How does this commodification of leisure contribute to that feeling of burnout? Just really trying to think through all of it.
I know. I think it's brilliant. And I'm really looking forward to our listeners getting a chance to hopefully read it. So I'll include a link of your choice to that book in the episode description. And thank you so much for talking to me about this today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.